My name is Drew Bowden. I'm the production designer on Man in the High Castle, and you're listening to the Go Creative Show.
Hey, everyone. My name is Ben Consoli. I am a director and owner of BC Media Productions. And this is the Go Creative Show, this show dedicated to creative professionals in the video production and filmmaking industries. Today, we go behind the scenes of The Man in the High Castle with production designer Drew Bowden. Drew shares his approach to creating the show's three distinct worlds, the Nazi-controlled East Coast, the Japanese-controlled West Coast, and the neutral zone in between. The Go Creative Show is supported by Rule Boston Camera, Hedge.video, Shutterstock, Magnanimous Rentals, and PremiumBeat.com. Well, we've got a great show for you guys today with a ton of information. The Man in the High Castle, to me, I think that's one of the best-looking shows available right now. And obviously the cinematography is absolutely gorgeous, but it's what the cinematographer is shooting that I think is so impressive with this show. And that's why we've got the production designer on, Drew Bowden, to talk about how he does it. I mean, the show has three distinct worlds. It has the East Coast, the West Coast, and the neutral zone. East is controlled by the Nazis. The West is controlled by Japan. And then they have the neutral zone. And all three of them have very distinct looks. So it's a blend of historical kind of fact and you know, going back in history and seeing what these time periods and these eras look like. But then there's also this twist of, you know, we're living in kind of a world that doesn't really exist. And combining all of those things was masterfully done by Drew and his team. And there's so many little tips in here. We talk a lot about how to age props as well, which was kind of cool. We never discussed that on the show before. And I learned a lot, so I know you guys will too. And I'm sure there's some things in here that you can pick up for your own projects, regardless if you listen and regardless if you watch the show or not. It doesn't matter. The information we have in here is for everyone. Before we get to the interview, just a couple of things. One, we want you guys to subscribe to the Go Creative Show on your favorite podcast app. What we found is that a good portion of our listeners are listening on the website, which is great. That's awesome. But when you subscribe, you get the most up-to-date episode immediately. So you never have to worry about missing one. It'll pop up in your podcast app automatically. So whichever one is your favorite, go to it, search for Go Creative Show, and click subscribe. It makes a huge difference for us. And it's also going to be great for you because you will never miss an episode. And why would you want to? Because we have so many amazing guests like Drew Bowden, who's going to be on in just a minute. But before we get there, I want to talk about Rule Boston Camera, because Rule is the place to go to purchase and rent your production equipment. We always talk about that, but today we're going to talk about something different, because Rule has a commitment to the production industry and they are dedicated to educating us. And one of the ways they do are through these events called Pub Nights. Now, Pub Nights are awesome because it's a great, they bring on guests. They have a whole panel going on sometimes. You know, your industry peers are all there. It's a networking event. They have pizza and beer, and it's just such a blast. And it's free. And the next one is going to be on Wednesday, September 11th. And this one's going to be all about ARRI. So there's going to be some guys from ARRI there. They're going to do a sneak peek with just accessories from 3 to 5 p.m. But then at 6 p.m., they have the pub night. And this is when they're going to talk about the LF, the mini LF. They're going to talk about their primes, their pro camera accessories, and so much more. So if you are an ARRI fan, if you are a cinematography fan, and of course you are, this is an event not to miss. It's free. It's happening Wednesday, September 11th, right in Boston. And the way you guys can RSVP is go to rule.com, rule.com/events. rule.com/events. Okay, let's move on to our interview with Drew Bowden, the production designer for The Man in the High Castle. So I'm here with Drew Bowden, the production designer for The Man in the High Castle, and so excited to have you on the Go Creative Show.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure.
So I want to talk about the three kind of worlds that exist in this show. I mean, we've got our sort of Nazi-controlled East Coast. We have our Japanese-controlled West Coast. Then we have this neutral zone in the middle. And all of them have kind of a different look and feel about them. And you, as the production designer, are kind of tasked with creating these worlds. That is a daunting task. I mean, you're basically making like three shows in one with this series.
Yeah, it was really, you know, it was one of the most fun kind of challenges you can have. And was even just to kind of add to that, the complication of that is it's also an alternative period that never happened. So, you know, you can kind of create the three different color palettes and the three different sensibilities, but it's also you're making them out of events that are totally different from history. And so it's really a fun, just such a great creative, you know, exercise for the directors and producers and for me, costumes and everybody to, you know, to think about, you know, the basic idea that World War II was lost and that the Nazis really took over the world with Imperial Japan. You know, it means that 1950s rock and roll never happened. You know, it means that Martin Luther King never became, you know, Martin Luther King. You know, it's like all these things that are sort of quintessentially American of the post-war era just never happened. And so what was fascinating about this world build was to divide up the space and then think about all the things that weren't there and then subtract them and then look at how, you know, what was left, you know, to work with and how would we arrange that through color. And this is just, you know, great. And of course, you know, you have sort of endless opportunities for interesting historical, you know, projection and theorizing. So we had just all these great conversations about, well, that's, you know, that 1957 car would not have a, you know, a fin. There would be no happiness. There would be only kind of a socialist, you know, conformist, you know, fascist sort of simplicity to things. And, you know, we looked at Eastern Europe and Soviet bloc countries for that sort of inspiration of where fascism was in the 60s, you know, because, you know, in our research, of course, the way things ended, of course, there was no fascism from Germany in the 60s. So we had to look over into, you know, into Soviet bloc countries for what is repression and, you know, pernicious, you know, fascism look like.
It's interesting that just hearing you talk about the concept of like removing things that are sort of distinctly American from our perceptions and figuring out like what's left, like that is an interesting way of approaching it. And it makes sense. It's like, what would America be if it wasn't what we thought, you know, if it wasn't us, what would
exactly
we be? And I like that. I like that concept of kind of removing. I think that's an interesting way of thinking about it. But before we really dive into like all the details of what makes each section unique and how you design them, how did you get involved with this show?
I had been working on a show with Scott Free, and I'd just done a big show there. And I also worked separately previously with the director, David Semmel, who directed the pilot. And they were talking, and they kind of both sort of mentioned my name sort of separately, but at the same time. About the project. So I sort of had the happy coincidence kind of come up. And so it was terrific. You know, I got the call and I was like, oh my gosh, I love this. I love this project.
Were you familiar with the book?
I had not read the book. I was familiar with, of course, Philip K. Dick's, you know, the filmed versions of his work, you know, the like sort of the epic achievement of Blade Runner and Minority Report, sort of being the high watermarks of, you know, kind of for me, for film.
Yeah.
You know, they're two of the great science fiction masterpieces of film. And so I was completely in kind of awe of the worlds that they, that were created by those different design teams and those directors. So, you know, the idea of having an opportunity to work anywhere near that was like gold.
Let's break this down. So we had mentioned earlier, we've got our kind of Nazi Germany East Coast look. We have our Imperial Japan West Coast look, and then this neutral zone. Let's kind of go through your process for creating. I guess let's start with the East Coast. Let's start with that sort of the Nazi Germany controlled New York City area, and of course the rest of the East Coast as well.
On the East Coast, we basically, you know, the East Coast is kind of a gray, stone, cold place and has winter in a general way. and combining that with the very dour, very gray, very concrete, very heavy, dark colors of the Eastern Bloc repressive regimes, plus the Nazi uniform colors and flag, gave us a palette of essentially warm and cold grays and black with red accent, a warm kind of orangey accent as well. Yeah. So in a sense, you know, with some khaki, some basically, again, based on, you know, sort of well understood, you know, memories of, you know, sort of shared memories we all have of watching films that have Nazi uniforms in them. There's certain colors that sort of, there's Luftwaffe gray uniforms, there's SS uniforms with silver pinstriping, there is Hitler's khaki, you know, personal, you know, jacket look, and of course, and there the flags.
Yeah.
So that sort of forms the basic palette for that whole side of things. And we limited the colors of the cars on the East Coast, you know, to black and gray, and you know, so we painted a lot of cars for the series, you know, and obviously the wardrobe was spectacular, and you know, a lot of custom built wardrobe for each palette to sort of tie that all together.
So now, how closely are you working with the wardrobe departments, the lighting department, to kind of make sure that your color palette stays intact?
Very closely. One of the things that used to be the case that you would make you'd make something, and then the DOP and directors and people in post would kind of grade the color after the fact.
Yeah.
So there's a period where you saw a lot of movies that were blue, or a lot of movies that were sepia, or and they just kind of adjusted the color on the whole shooting match. What we did is we pre-aged a lot of the colors in the wardrobe and the sets to go together with each other in a faded way, so that it was not necessary to crank the knobs. Hmm. And that allowed the DOP on the set to really make decisions based on, well, how is the lighting going to look in this really best in this moment, and not have to think, you know, excessively about, I'm going to grade this all down later. And so we worked really hard. Audrey Fisher and I worked really hard in that first season to establish this look, where we went through and looked at a lot of vintage photographs of that time and from the different areas of the world. And we could sort of see the different colors that sort of happened because of the light in the different areas of the world. On the West Coast, it's more watery, and you know, but we'll get to that in a second. But
yeah.
You know,
and
so
who was Audrey?
Audrey Fisher was the costume designer.
Okay.
In season one.
All right. So we've sort of limited our color palette. We have that kind of harsh, prominent red. You know, it's interesting to talk to you about how you were not relying on post to sort of desaturate or change the color of things. Because I was just assuming that there must be something going on. I mean, car colors, you know, wardrobe. I know, of course, you're always striving to have everything fit a particular palette, but it's so tempting to just rely on post sometimes to do some of that work. It sounds like you guys just didn't do that at all. You wanted to keep it as authentic as possible.
That's right. And it's, we don't really trust, because you know, the costume designer and I are gone at the end. You know, when it goes to post, we basically lose control over that. And,
yeah.
And so that control goes to the director and the director of photography. And for a variety of reasons, usually they don't call the designer or back and say, hey, you know, how do you feel about this color?
Yeah.
So for us, it was important to just make sure that did not happen, and that we, you know, could ensure that it would look great.
Talk to me about the prep that goes into sort of creating this. Where are you getting your inspiration from?
Well, we each kind of did deep dives into the historical research of the period pre and leading into the Nazi period, both in Germany and the United States, and also in Japan. And then, because you know, history changes at that moment, you know, then we looked around, well, where do we find the reference that we can base this new period on? And there isn't any. So that's kind of coming back to where, you sort of say, well, okay, then what are some parallels of that? And that's where we kind of found our sort of references in the Eastern Bloc, where you can sort of see this weird modernism that was happening in communist countries while America was having, you know, Elvis and, you know, Marilyn Monroe and, you know, 57 Chevys. You know, the Eastern Bloc countries were living in this Cold War where it was very, very repressive in its appearance. And, you know, we realized that to bring this sort of the fascist idea forward in time and then lay it and transpose it on top of American culture, that we sort of needed to take that look and stick it into America, you know, sort of insert it into Times Square, literally, and then mix the two things together. And Frank Spotnitz, who wrote the script, was also keen that whatever we did, it didn't become so dystopian that we couldn't feel the connection to real America. In other words, the reality that America can go fascist. Yeah. You know, the essential message of the material is that it can happen anywhere and you have to be on guard. And as we are all now living through what can happen when people are not really on guard to the reality of fascism in America, you know, the one of the objectives was not to make it too different from the America that we know, but to make it different enough that we could truly understand, you know, what would be removed. But you can see how there are elements of our society that would be easily tempted to sort of fall in line and get behind a fascist leader.
It's interesting. You're right, because you when you watch it, it's familiar. Like you have to make the viewer connect to both sides of things. They need to connect to the American side of it, but they also need to connect to the Nazi side of it and sort of that fascist side of it, because neither one of them is new. Like we've seen what these are. We've experienced both of these from a visual standpoint, and you need to blend them together. I'm thinking that maybe, you know, I'm wondering, how are you making it uniquely American? What are some of the decisions that you made to keep that familiarity with the America side?
Well, I want to share some things with you. But before that, I want to just kind of share something else that, you know, many people don't know. But at the time before America entered the war, there was a very large American Bund, basically an American Nazi party. It was so large in the United States that it filled Madison Square Garden in New York. And you can literally Google that. You can see these massive rally for American Nazis who were saying, you know, we don't want to, you know, we want to join Hitler. We don't want to fight Hitler.
Yeah.
So the reality of our history is it's not that America was always on the quote unquote right side of this, and that you know, that there weren't, you know, and that there was no one who wasn't against Hitler. Actually, there were a whole bunch of Americans who thought Hitler was just fine. Mm. And it was a big deal, and it was a big struggle to get into the war and to get that segment of society to cut it out and change, you know, their racist beliefs, at least suppress their racist beliefs enough for the country to do the right thing.
I'm looking at a picture of it right now. I spent some time in Nuremberg last fall, and you know, really just learned so much. I mean, there's so much history over there anyway. But yeah, they talked a lot about the Nazi influence in America, and it was really interesting because I mean, you hear about it, you think about it, but you don't. When you actually see that picture of Madison Square Garden full, as if it was a rock concert, it's a horrifying image.
It's totally horrifying. And you know, there was a charismatic Lincoln Rockwell was this charismatic American Nazi. You know, these were all sort of KKK people. And you know, we are seeing now, and just in the last couple of years, we are seeing Nazis marching. You know, of course, famously in the last couple of years, and tragically, in Charlottesville, we saw people openly marching, doing Nazi slogans, carrying flags, and people got killed. So, as Americans, we have somewhat lulled ourselves into believing that we don't have a problem with racism in the country and that we don't have to be on guard against the reality of that. And it's just not true. We have a terrible problem. and we have a very substantial issue to confront. And you know, when we started making the show, it was well before the current administration was elected. But you know, the country was starting to, in a very unfortunate way, the sort of the mirror or the storytelling mirror that was being held up by the story that was written in 1962, at a time when nobody could imagine the Nazis taking over America. It was almost the most ridiculous thing a person could suggest by writing a science fiction novel, is that America got taken over, right? It's just laughable. But the genius of Philip K. Dick was that in asking that essential question, well, what if it did happen that way? What would the morals of the country really be like? You know, who would make the right decisions, and would they, or would they just fall in line? And you know, that great way in which a masterpiece of science fiction can really wrestle with deep moral questions, you know, that book did it. Mm. So you fast forward, and we're producing this thing, and then after we've got a couple of seasons under our belt, this happens in the country. We get this conservative, you know, assault on our political system, this fascist, you know, kind of assault on our political system. So it's very interesting. We were sort of in the middle of doing a warning, kind of sending up a warning flare, and you know, and now we're here. So you know, and, I know that no TV show, like there's no TV show or movie that is really big enough to really deal with the problem that we have. You know, we can send out a message, we can highlight the things that need to be addressed, but in truth, the society at large has to take moral responsibility for what happens, what's happening at the border right now, what's happening throughout the country in our institutions. You know, it is the country's moral responsibility, and that means all of us to you know, to vote in ways that reflect, you know, our best, you know, as Lincoln said, our better angels.
Do you feel like The Man in the High Castle is, you know, you had said that after two seasons, you feel that there's been a major change in the country. Are you feeling now that The Man in the High Castle is kind of becoming the voice of resistance in politics, well, in the world? I mean, has it become kind of is this now a political show?
Well, it is more so. And you know, it's funny. It was always a political show, but it's sort of like everything around it changed in the middle of the show. You know, and writers changed, and other things changed, but also the world changed around it. And what at the beginning of the process would have been an unthinkable rise in fascism that actually took place around the world, and is happening right now. And so, you know, in the third season, there is a much stronger resistance and a much stronger symbolic and also sort of filmed aspect of protest and of really pushing back against it, and much more so in the fourth season. So you know, it's interesting. You know, there was some sense by some of the writers that we shouldn't be, you know, too topical about what was really happening around us. But I also think that, like most Americans, we're in shock about the scale of the change that was truly coming. You know, the sort of the supposition that, well, you know, we've seen lots of different things, and you know, America couldn't possibly change that much in the course of you know, administration. It is my opinion and belief that, in fact, we have seen tremendous negative change in really destructive ways to what are the core beliefs of our American democracy. So in that way, you know, it's sort of like, you know, things, you know, they used to say that 9/11 changed everything. And it did in so many ways. This administration has changed everything in an even much more dramatic way about who we are as a nation, and how we are in the world, and how we show up for each other and our fellow human beings. And not to the good, not to the better, in my opinion. It has been a terrible, terrible result.
I can certainly hear and feel your passion for this. I think You know, it's an interesting, I really wasn't thinking that this conversation would go down a political path, but we're here. I mean, let's go with it.
I think it's kind of inescapable. I mean, yeah, we can absolutely talk about the artistry, and I'm very proud of it for sure. And, you know, and I have the amazing colleagues that I've worked with, and, you know, and they're all so deserving of recognition for it. It's like to not mention, you know, because the core spine of the piece is about this idea of fascism taking over America. I sort of feel like a sense of moral responsibility that I can't talk about the show without talking about that.
Hmm. Well, jumping off of that idea of moral responsibility, is there something that you're doing in your production design that that has changed over the course of the past couple years? In subsequent seasons, like, are you doing things in production design that are more reflective of what you feel is going on today, that perhaps maybe you wouldn't have if things were different?
Well, it's interesting. It's sort of more, it was more in the writing and the story than so much the design per se, because our sort of the power structure is sort of fixed in the story. So it isn't like, you know, a different regime takes over. Rather, it's we spend more time with the resistance, and we spend more time in the center of the country, which is the, you know, my favorite part of it.
The neutral zone, yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, that's where everybody is free, and, you know, where the color palette is all colors but muted. And, you know, there's a sense of America lost in that part of it. And, you know, that's a part of the message that is, I think, super important, but it's enormously subtle, but it's very important.
Let's take a minute and talk about Shutterstock.com. Shutterstock has this new thing now. They've introduced something called Elements, and these are thousands of cinema-grade video effects for filmmakers. They're blockbuster quality, and they're created by industry professionals. So you're going to get things like 4K lens flares, transitions, video kits with smoke, fire, explosions, and all sorts of stuff. You can check it all out at Shutterstock.com. Now, this is perfect because I'm already at Shutterstock looking for stock footage and photos and music and all sorts of stuff. Their blog is amazing, and I go there all the time. But now with Elements, someone like me that's just, you know, an enthusiast with when it comes to visual effects, I like to dabble in it, but I would never charge anybody for me personally doing any video effects. But I like to play around. And, you know, these Elements are perfect for me because they're super high quality. They're not that expensive, and they're easy to use in my preferred NLE. The other thing that's great is for those of you that are expert at visual effects, you're also going to benefit from Elements because the quality is amazing. So they're made for people that are at the highest end and the lowest end, like me, when it comes to visual effects. And they're not that expensive. So the price is right, especially for the quality you get. So I encourage you, head over to Shutterstock.com, hover over footage, and then right there in the dropdown is Elements. And just check them out. Just play with them a little bit and see what you think. I know you're going to love them. You know what else I know you're going to love? Is Hedge. Yes, Hedge is a backup software for filmmakers. It's super fast. It's super easy to use. I love it because you can set multiple sources and multiple destinations all at the same time. So what I mean by that is, let's say you've got your camera operators, your audio tech, they all give you media, and you're responsible for backing everything up. You know, before Hedge, you just throw it all on the, you know, on your desktop, you drag files all over the Finder, and it's just a big mess. But when you use Hedge, it is just so much more professional, and you get the peace of mind knowing that everything was done correctly. You can take all of your media cards and set them as sources. You take all of your hard drives or wherever you're sending it to, and those are your destinations. Press transfer, and it's done. That's it. It just goes. And if you have the Hedge Connect app for your phone, it'll alert you when the transfer is done. So it's peace of mind. It's the fastest way to transfer your media, and it's the right way. Do it professionally. Stop dilly-dallying in the Finder. It's stupid. So head over to hedge.video/gocreativeshow and check it out. They have a whole bunch of different licenses, and you can get 20% off the full license by typing in Go Creative Show in the coupon code. And it's all there at hedge.video/gocreativeshow. So yeah, let's talk about that neutral zone area. Now this, you had said everyone is free, but it is also kind of the Wild West. I mean, there, everyone is free, yes, but there's also kind of no rules there. So sort of anything can happen. And I think that's an interesting distinction because you aren't following rule of law, but that also sort of allows kind of anything to go on. How are you reflecting that from, well, first of all, do you agree? And if so, how are you reflecting that in the design?
Absolutely. I totally agree. And the writer for the head writer for that season, Eric Overmeyer, you know, wrote this key set for the neutral zone, the Denver Palace set, which we built. And the set was based on the discussion about Rick's American Cafe in Casablanca. And, you know, the idea of, you know, in that movie, it's a sort of a neutral place, but it's, you know, it's in between the Nazis and it's somewhere related to Europe and in, you know, Bogart's world. And anybody can come through Rick's American Cafe and some people get arrested, some people don't get arrested, payoffs are made, deals are made. And so he wanted to set up a sandbox like that within our story, which was absolutely terrific. So, you know, I went and I looked at that feeling of that particular nightclub space, and I'd always liked this kind of, you know, Midwest kind of Sullivan architectural arches thing and Beaux-Arts architecture. So we built a set with these overlapping arches that is sort of is reminiscent of the way that the Rick's American Cafe set in that Casablanca film worked. And kind of gives us some sort of pressure from above. You know, I like physical set spaces that have, you know, have structure or weight above where people are being oppressed. And in our case, we're in the sort of the, you know, sort of the nerve center of the people who are going to be resistance, you know, passing through. The other thing about that set was...
What was the name of the set again? I want to pull up a picture as we're talking.
Yeah, it's the Denver Palace. And it's arches with their gold and the peeling paint and things like that. That set, you know, is one of the things I love about it is that it is like the photographs that of Robert Polidori of Cuba. You know, it's like things frozen in time, but they're kept. You know, like you don't get rid of the car, you just keep it running. You don't. Yeah. Get rid of the interior of that. You just keep it and you let the paint peel because it's too emotionally crippling to repaint it or get rid of the car. You want to hold on to the idea that those cars represent. And the neutral zone is very much in its entirety, just like that idea. You want to hold on to old America. You don't want new cars that are built in Germany. You want old cars from the 40s. Mm. You want to leave the painted signage and the old posters and all the stuff on the walls from before the war, even though you lost, you want to hold on to all that stuff and all those memories and the way America was. And so that set is really emblematic of that.
Yeah. I'm looking at pictures now. I mean, it's absolutely gorgeous, first of all. And you're right. It's that every single set, I think throughout the whole show has that feeling of, everything is familiar. Everything's a little scary. Everything feels old. It's just, you're blending in so many different emotions in all of these sets. And that's, you know, besides even thinking about color, which in Neutral Zone has the most color out of anything, but it's just really, really well designed. I'm actually looking at the set designer's website. It just popped up. What's the name here so I can plug it? What was your set designer's name? Where is it? Oh, Austin Wang.
Yes.
That's who I'm looking at. Yeah. I mean, we've got that. And then we also have that really beautiful, like 2001 Space Odyssey type set, the sort of medical looking environment. I mean, just really, really gorgeous stuff.
Oh, I love that you're going over to Austin's website. That's terrific. He's just a wonderful designer and just a great guy. So it's great that his name is being highlighted. Thank you.
Oh yeah. We'll put a link to this in the show notes. Cause I mean, we've got a whole bunch of Man in the High Castle stuff and, I mean, his work is awesome anyway. So you guys should check it out.
Great.
So talk to me about kind of the other things in the neutral zone that allow it to be, I guess, unique to the rest of the country, but how are you sort of muting that? You mentioned a little while ago that color is allowed, but you're muting it. Talk to me more about that.
We saw these references, and you know, if you go into an old like a thrift shop and you see some things from the 1940s, or you know, they have a certain the colors are a little bit sunlight faded, they're a little bit dusty, they're a little bit, and so they have a kind of a muted overall quality. They were, you know, the red was bright, you know, 70 years ago, but it's not bright now.
Yeah.
And we kind of lifted that idea because in a way, you know, America went through the Great Depression starting in 1929, and then it goes into this horrible war that it loses in our story. So in a way, time stops at 1929 in a lot of America. Mm. And only, you know, it only if through the effort and the money coming in from either the Imperial Japanese resources or the Nazi resources, is there any new money coming into the American system? So armed with that, you know, we sort of exaggerated the idea that everything just kind of stopped and just kind of got dustier and dustier. And so we would literally, you know, we'd put lots of things together and then we would just go through and dust them and age them and soften them and do that. And in a kind of a wonderfully satisfying way, doing that actually makes it more colorful, ironically, you know, because the subtlety of many colors together can actually be quite colorful and rich rather than lots of bright colors feeling, you know, cheap.
Yeah.
Sometimes when there are too many bright colors within a frame, it feels like a candy store, and that brings up associations of cheapness rather than luxurious, you know, color tone.
Huh. That's interesting, but I can see it. I mean, I'm trying to do an A-B comparison in my mind, but yeah, I can see that. I think there's something about the old patina of like leather and glass and wood and stuff that even though it's older, it has this kind of richness to it that
exactly.
You don't have if it's brand new.
Exactly.
And then I think what's interesting to me about the neutral zone is it's a time preserved. Like it's untouched by really anybody. It's untouched by America, but it's also untouched by Germany or Japan. And it's just kind of a time capsule that is left to kind of rot in a weird way.
Exactly. And it also suffers from a certain amount of, you know, predatory looting or, you know, just picking over the bones.
Yeah.
You know, after 17 years, you know, of kind of people trying to just scrape out some kind of existence, you know, there's a lot of things are just gone. And then other things are just heavily used and reused. And it's really very fascinating. The Robert Polidori books of Cuba really set a really good example, was a kind of a good reference for us because of the scarcity of new things and, and just having to keep the things you've got going, just keep them going, right? And that's also very much a Depression era reality. And so you kind of put the two things together and you have the opportunity for a fairly extreme level of hardship in terms of just not having stuff. So we aged a lot of cars and we painted lots of automobiles and, you know, aged a lot of walls and set pieces and things to kind of really keep driving home the point that, you know, things just aren't new in the neutral zone.
What is the aging process? Like, what are you actually doing?
Well, we had just a phenomenal paint team. And so, you know, sometimes it's aging a piece of furniture, literally dyeing the furniture, literally painting, literally sanding, you know, the furniture itself or the automobile or the wall. And, you know, there's a whole combination of technical ways to do it with a variety of paints, sometimes waxes, and then literal dust, literal ash. And one of my favorite things to do is to actually go to a set and throw gravel at it and, you know, shovel.
What do you mean?
A lot of times a set will get dressed, say it's a back alley or some exterior place.
Yeah.
And in a society where there's no one really who's interested in cleaning anything up, you can see these kinds of sets in lots of different shows and movies. And, you know, depending upon how many layers of textures there are, to my eye, is the difference between a really great job of it and an okay job of it. Hmm. And so there's things like dust and random bits of paper that you don't know where they came from, and pieces of gravel that wouldn't ordinarily be in the places that they are, but to the camera, you don't know what they are, and they create this texture. And places, you know, surfaces look like they've been there. Like you can take an old box or a barrel, for example, and you can put it next to an old wall. And that's one version of creating a period place. For me, I like to go in and then put dead leaves and gravel and sand and throw it up in the air and let it settle on everything. So there's an atmospheric and physical debris layer on top of whatever was just put there 5 minutes ago. Huh. And it gives it gives a history and time to objects. And it's not a hard thing to do. It's a step that I love to not forget. And I personally like to do it because it's just fun for me, because it's sort of like putting a final touch on a painting or something. And I like to get my hands dirty and like to sort of reach into the bags of cement and other things. And people are like, oh, stop, don't you know? And like, it's fun for me.
So you know that the set is finished when you come in with a big barrel of gravel and dirt.
That's right. Just, and if they know I'm coming, they're like, oh, make sure you have a little gravel or dirt for Drew to throw around, and he'll be happy.
That is wild. I've never heard anybody talk about that before. Is this kind of unique to you, or is this just sort of the way people do it?
It's the way people do it. I just, you know, there's the position of greensman is a very important and interesting position that is not often called out. But
what's the name of the position?
Greensman or greensperson.
I've never even heard of it. Who was a greens person?
That person is responsible for any kind of trees, plants, grass, natural materials or growing things that you would see either on a stage or at a location. And there are times when we'll go to a location and we'll literally create a forest that wasn't there. And that's the greens person's job. Or we'll go into an area that is like a clean alley, and we'll bring a bunch of gravel and broken rocks and dirt to make the alley look more 1930s rather than, you know, 2019.
So they're sort of responsible for any natural element that is just happens to be there, whatever's on the ground, you know, trees, anything that's kind of, you know, from the
exactly.
earth.
Exactly. And, you know, I've loved every time whenever I've worked with any greens person anywhere, I've always just loved the experience, because, you know, it's a very tactical and very tactile and very real art form. And, you know, to kind of go into the set and then add that sort of layer from the greens department on top of the set dressing department's work, on top of the construction and paint department's work, on top of the picture vehicles department's work, you know, then it just becomes this whole blended thing. Like you're just kind of, I guess it's analogous to like, say you bake a cake and you put the frosting, the sort of powdered confection sugar on the top at the last minute, and you go, ah, magnifique.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I mean, at this moment I have that, that palace set up. It's just been on my screen, so I've been really looking at it. And I'm observing things like the way that wallpaper is sort of falling off in certain points, and there's like soot marks and just the aging of everything. I mean, I'm looking at this, I'm like, this must have taken forever, because every single detail is thought of.
So it's just, I have to give it up to Darcy and Sarah. The paint team is just extraordinary. And the, you know, we custom designed the wallpaper and printed it graphically, so it had a little digital age in it. But we then handed it off to the paint department, who physically textured the wall and then peeled wallpaper back and then added layers of aging on top of that. And then they just kept going and kept going, because, you know, in similar to talking about the greens thing, there's this whole universe of amazing scenic artists, and it's the right phrase, because the level of paint craft is so high. It is really kind of, I feel very privileged and very very lucky when I sort of offer up a set, and I just know that if I can make sure to give enough time to a really talented team of painters, that they're going to go in and make something so much more beautiful than I can even imagine. It's sort of like, it's like a challenge you share with your friends. You say, oh yeah, well, I bet you can't run up that hill. And they not only run up the hill, they run up the next hill after it. And you're like, oh my God, So the layers and the detail and the quality of that painting is just, it's such a thing to behold in person. You know, on film it's extraordinary, but when you're standing in it, it's even more magnificent. And it was so much fun. That's the set that visiting directors, they would kind of walk into it and they would just go, wow. And you know, these would be directors from lots of big shows who would kind of come to town, and they would come into our world, and they would go into that set and they would just go, wow, this is the most beautifully painted set. And you know, it always gave me such joy to hear that. And so I'm very, really proud of that one on behalf of, you know, the whole team of, you know, Austin Construction, the whole team. Darcy and Sarah just crushed it.
You are listening to the PremiumBeat.com Song of the Week. This one's called Chill Hop Trippin' by Matthias Bueller. Premium Beat is where to go for all of your royalty-free music and sound effects. Head over to premiumbeat.com to get an access to a collection of thousands of royalty-free tracks for as low as $49 each, under $50. And guess what? It's not just the one track. You get stems, you get cutdowns, you get loop sets. What that really means is you can customize the track to fit your project perfectly. So head over there, premiumbeat.com. Check out this song. You know, any of our other songs of the weeks. We've had, 183 of them now? And just explore for yourself. premiumbeat.com. And lastly, before we get to the last part of our interview, we still got a little more people. You know us. I want to talk about Magnanimous Rentals. Magnanimous Rentals over at magrents.com. It's a production equipment rental website. It's based in Chicago. That's where you can go physically to pick things up if you live in the area. But if you don't, it's fine because they ship anywhere in the country. Now, they got an amazing inventory. That's the first thing. But the most important thing are their prices. Now, I say this all the time. You guys will not believe the prices. It's insanity. Their regular prices are incredible. But then they also have these things called flash discounts. And these are steeply discounted items, sometimes up to 50% off. But it's only for a limited time. So the thing to do is go to magrents.com every day. I mean, I make magrents.com one of the sites I visit all the time because I always want to know what's on flash discount. And they put good stuff on there, real good stuff. I mean, I got an Alexa package on flash discount. I'm looking at it right now. They've got an Osmo on flash. They've got a C100 on flash discounts. A couple of lenses. Like, there's just so much over there. So head over to magrents.com, check out what they have to offer, especially the flash discounts. But remember, it's a limited time. So you have to place the rental during the time that the flash discount is going on so that you can take advantage of the ridiculously discounted prices. So head over there, magrents.com. Go there now. Go there every day. You never know what you will find. All right. Let's get ready for the remaining portion of our interview with production designer for The Man in the High Castle, Drew Boughton. Talk to me about working with directors, because, you know, unlike a film, TV shows, as we all know, oftentimes have multiple directors per season coming in and out, guest directors and all that. Where my assumption is that the production designer and the showrunner are sort of like, your job is to make sure that there's consistency across the entire season, regardless of director. But there has to be some, you know, every director, I'm sure, wants to have put their own stamp on their episode. So can you talk to me about the working relationship with the directors on the show?
Absolutely. And I just want to add in that the executive producing director and executive producers are also a part of that. You know, I, as the production designer, sort of uniquely positioned in a kind of a visual quality control assistant position. You know, like, it's certainly true that a production designer on a big TV show with incoming directors has more influence than would be had in a regular feature film situation. But it is also mostly essential that I am to be of service, because you're absolutely right. That director can come in and they can only affect certain things. So they have one or two things that they want to do in their episode that will make it special. And so it's critically important for me to support them in that. And what's great for me, and is in all honesty, is I've worked with so many interesting directors, and I've learned so much from each one of them by doing that. You know, rather than holding the company line as some sort of an assignment, it's actually the opposite. It's like, no, actually, what I really want to do is do something different than the company line. And this person is like a walking unique opportunity for me to do that. So that's sort of how I, you know, how I experience the directors who come through. And I just, you know, they've just been fantastic people.
Not to put you on the spot, but can you point to like one set or design change or something different that a director came in and changed that, you know, perhaps maybe otherwise wouldn't if you hadn't had that influence?
You know, I can't think of any single specific one, but there are lots and lots of them.
Yeah.
And many times it's you know, maybe I can talk about it from a different angle. You know, as a designer, you know, you have a certain amount of physical resources, monetary resources, and you think, okay, I'm going to make a set, and, you know, the primary angle, quote unquote, it'll be seen from is from over here. And part of what you're doing when you do that is you're trying to limit the amount of stuff you have to make because you don't have enough money. Mm. Like, you know, you hear the description of like a 3-wall set versus a 4-wall set. And the difference is that a 4-wall set is just that much more money and dressing and time and all of these sorts of things. So a lot of times I have, you know, presented directors with sort of locations or physical sets where it was sort of like, yeah, I got this great set. It's a 3-wall. It's a da da da. And the director will, you know, sort of think about that for a second. And some of the ones who are the most challenging and have really been the most good for me have been the ones who just said, you know what, Drew, I get that you don't have a lot of money, but I need to reverse. Mm. And, you know, for the people in the industry, you know, there's the reverse is like, if you and I are talking and the camera looks at you and then the camera looks at me, I'm the reverse.
Yeah.
And there has to be something behind me. And if there isn't, because your production designer gave you only 3 walls, suddenly you're, as a director, you're kind of screwed. And you're sort of like, God, I wish there was a wall back there, or I wish there was a location back there. So one of the great gifts of this really amazing directors that come through is that, you know, the ones who say, you know what, I get it, but I got to have something. And then we sort of figure out what that something is. Or they find a way to block it so that they can shoot it, you know, sort of cheat the reverse, which is a very common thing. Mm. But that, you know, that interaction is really, you know, I learned so much about, you know, what is directing and what is editing and what is storytelling. You know, there's the emotional moment when you want to just stay with that lead actor and you're just watching that person for the whole scene. And then there are the times when it's like a boxing match and it's got to go back and forth between two strong actors, you know, just sort of fighting sort of metaphorically. And, you know, you need a set for that on both sides that's equal.
I want to just take a minute and talk about visual effects because, you know, obviously there's set extensions and things like that, especially when you're doing your big, huge, wide shots to show the locations. Talk to me about your relationship and how you work with visual effects.
It's great because, first of all, I just want to brag on Lawson Deming and Barnstorm because they're really an extraordinary team, and I hope that they more than deserve the recognition. I hope they win because they deserve it. So yes, I mean, how it sort of works for me is that we'll go scouting with the director and myself and the supervisor, Lawson Deming, and we'll sort of discuss, you know, where we think something might be extended, and then I'll take a photograph of if it's a location, and then I'll sketch in the CG elements that are going to be added. For example, a giant dome in Berlin, or Nazi flags in the skyline, or something like that. And, you know, sometimes I will then, my rough color drawing will then go to an illustrator in the art department who will develop a much more realistic impression of that. And then that will then go to visual effects to build 3D model and begin all of their prep. But that sort of that conversational stage done through the early drawings allows the director and the DOP and the producer to say, yes, we agree. We want to see a giant Berlin dome in the background of that shot. And so I do that in a very loose, sketchy way. And then I'll say to Lawson, I say, what do you think? Can you do this? Should I show it to anybody? You know, like, you know, if I show this drawing, am I going to make your life, you know, hell? You know, that kind of conversation.
Yeah. Yes.
Do you like it? You know, and so, you know, and sometimes, as in season two, we had an entirely digital set of the interior of the Berlin Dome. And we hired a digital set designer in the art department because, you know, that's a period architectural structure that has classical details. And it's the sort of thing that a visual effects house can do, but a trained sort of historically architecturally trained set designer who does digital 3D models does a quicker job at.
Yeah.
And that is something that is commonly done as a step where it's done, and it's done within the art department, and you get a sort of a pre-vis level of model out of it that then can go through the various approval steps. And that way, you know, people are confident when they're shooting it what it's going to be, but also the visual effects team has a good handle on what the thing the director wants is, so that, God forbid, when they go and invest, you know, hundreds of hours of you know, visual effects time in it, it really is the thing everybody agrees to. So it's a really wonderful and it's a great relationship. It's a great creative space, you know, sort of working with especially a team as talented as Lawson and Barnstorm.
Let's talk about the Japanese Pacific states and the look of this, where it came from, and how it differs. We've talked about the East. We've talked about the neutral zone. What does the West look like?
So it is, in a similar way, we used, if you think about the atmosphere and the climate of the East Coast as being cold and wintry and grays and dark buildings, you can think about the West Coast as being warm and watery and, you know, kind of aquatic along the edge. And you can see that really in the photography of that part of the country anyway. You can just see the colors. And historically, there are lots of period aquas and blues and things that really are associated with the West Coast. So we, you know, kind of used that basic idea and then again added the uniform colors, in this case, the Kempeitai military greens from the Imperial Japanese presence in our story, as the sort of the anchoring colors of that world. And it extended to picture vehicles. Once again, we painted a lot of cars blue and aqua and, you know, blue-green and, you know, the kinds of these things. And a lot of wardrobe that sort of in background shots you can see blues and aquas and things kind of feathered through the look of the thing. So the objective was so that without saying with a title, without writing words across the screen where you are, that the audience would be able to sort of feel where they are.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, without that, you do kind of lose track of where you are. And I think this show in particular does a great job of knowing, or at least as you're watching, you know where you are no matter what.
And yeah, you can feel it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then we have this alternate world that we're introduced to in season three, or it's revealed in season two, right? That there's kind of this alternate world. Talk to me about this, because now you're introducing a new world that we're kind of figuring out, does it exist? Does it not? What is its tie into reality? And we're kind of learning about it. How are you introducing that? Because up until that point, we've only seen it through the films, which of course are black and white.
Yes. And so, you know, it's interesting. We were really super confident with our three palette thing. And then they started throwing other palettes at us.
Yeah. And, at least when it was black and white, you could at least handle it.
That's right. Yeah. And since we were operating with sort of real subtlety between them, we started to run out of bandwidth, so to speak. And so what we did is we said, okay, so in our sort of like quote unquote real 62, you know, we'll kind of just go for full color as normal. And so we did that in season two and three to kind of you know, to sort of affect that. And it's just interesting. It's also a little bit stylistically about how it's photographed as well.
Yeah.
But you know, so that you know, and it, for me, I, you know, to be honest, I like it when it's a little bit more tightly controlled. Anyway, it's just my natural preference.
Yeah.
So the sort of the more wide open palette is something that's less attractive to me. But in order to have contrast, you sort of have to do something. So, you know, just kind of open it up a little bit and not be too precious about it.
Now, looking at the entire, you know, series as it is now, we've, you know, every one through three is out, four is on the way.
Yeah.
How has the production design evolved?
Well, I think what has been wonderful is the wonderful team of people stayed all the way through the construction, paint, set dressing, and you know, everybody you know, really stayed, and they stayed with the project, and we all got better together, and I got more confident, and I was able to give them larger opportunities because production said, you know what, let's build a bigger set now, let's do this now, let's do that now, because they also could sort of see how strong their crews were. And so I happily was able to, you know, say, okay, let's try this. Now let's do that. And so, you know, things are bigger and larger, and people will see in season four that we've built even larger sets. And this was really very, very satisfying. And the whole time, you know, the standards of fit and finish and, you know, the quality of the work that the crews were doing has just been just getting better and better and better all the way up to the final episode. And so I you know, they started impressing me from the very beginning and they just kept going. So, you know.
This is a dream show. Like, this is awesome. You're on a hit show. You're in your fourth season. It's like, what a great gig. It's just so cool. Like you get to play. So it was such a wonderful creative playground that you found here with this show. It's amazing.
It's fantastic. Just fantastic. I feel truly, really, truly so grateful and so lucky to have had the opportunity. Yep.
We have an audience question, but we kind of answered it. But I still want to at least acknowledge the question. Chadwin on Twitter, first of all, thank you for listening. But his question was, how did you keep a consistent color palette and texture throughout the series? I mean, I feel like we kind of answered it, but maybe, you know, you want to give it another crack just to kind of, you know, talk to me about it. I mean, is there something that you did to keep that color consistent throughout?
There is. We actually had, we had color reference boards with sample colors basically posted in every, like in the key offices, in, you know, wardrobe and props and paint. You know, everybody sort of had this basically a collage that I did for the very first pilot episode that showed a kind of a range of colors for each world. And everybody had that. So everybody sort of, you know, had that as a kind of a constant background presence. They could always kind of look up, you know, on the office wall and see that. And then, you know, I just kind of was always kind of checking and, you know, and because I had the same paint team, and, you know, it makes such a difference when you have that kind of consistent artistic, because, you know, people see colors very differently. Like, no two people really see like a blue the same way. Mm. And like you, if you talk to people about the subtlety of color, it's a really interesting thing to see how people represent. I had this great class in college, just a super quick story. And it was about, how to take pictures out of magazines and then declare what colors they were. And it was the perfect training for like a production designer job to sort of say, well, these are warm blues. And, you know, when someone says, well, go find me a bunch of warm blues. And, you know, it was a fascinating exercise because you intellectually, you think, well, all blue is cold. Mm. But in truth, that's not the case.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the same is true with all the other colors. Most other colors have all these different sort of varieties of warmth or coolness. And depending upon how the light is, or depending upon how much yellow you toss in or pull out or whatever. And so, having a paint team that really understands where my eyes are at, once we're locked in that way, it's like I never had to kind of worry about that. If another team had come in, I would have had to introduce them to it. Mm. And that's where you sometimes would get inconsistencies on other shows or other projects where that's happened.
Well, the show is phenomenal. It looks amazing. I mean, the work that you did on it is incredible. And of course, your whole team, who I'm sure you've been giving credit to throughout this whole episode, and for good reason. But the show is great. And the season 4 is coming fall 2019. We're all super excited for that. And is there anything, you know, what can we expect from season 4? You had mentioned bigger sets, which is cool, but is there something that you're bringing to it that you can sneak onto the show just to tell us about?
I don't quite know. I just encourage everybody to watch it, and I just hope you like it.
Oh, you know, I try to get juice out of things. Sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. No, but Drew, honestly, thank you so much for being on. I really appreciate it. Your work is great, and I can't wait to have you back. Oh, do you have an Instagram, and do you have places where people should follow you?
They can follow me on Twitter, and I'm just Drew Boughton at Twitter. Warning, I'm pretty political.
Well, I can see you tossed it into this interview, which I think is cool.
So other than that, yeah, come on.
He has something to say. So I like that. You got to put things out there sometimes. And, it's interesting. We very rarely have political discussions on the show, so it's welcome. People are free to say whatever the hell they want on this show. That's for sure.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you. This has just been so much fun. I really, really appreciate it.
There he goes, Drew Boughton, production designer for The Man in the High Castle. I love that show. I'm psyched for the new season. It's going to be awesome. You know what else is awesome? Matt Russell. Matt Russell mixes and masters and makes this show sound so good. You can find him over at gainstructure.com and on Twitter at gainstructure. I want you also to be paying attention to our producer, Connor Crosby. So if you like the guest that we've had lately, it's him. It's not me. It's him, people. You can find him at ignitionvisuals.com. And while you're around, go on everybody's website. Go to ours, gocreativeshow.com. And most importantly, go to your favorite podcast app and click subscribe on Go Creative Show and get the latest episode immediately. Never miss an episode again. Of course, I want to thank our sponsors, Hedge.video, Premium Beat, Shutterstock, Magnanimous Rentals, and Rule Boston Camera. Without these guys, the show wouldn't exist, so please support those that support us. See you next week.